Pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate, you're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, dear listener. This is episode 62 of the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. With me is a quickly recovering Velvet Glove from his cycle accident. Scott, I believe you're on the mend.
I am on the mend, thanks, Trevor. Yeah, I'm getting better.
That's good. You
know, it's all right. The stitches are out now and that sort of stuff. Excellent. Swelling's going down and I've got, well, full movement in my fingers and that sort of stuff. My hand is starting to move backwards again.
Very good. Excellent. Yes. Good to hear.
So I'd like to thank the Deep Throat who did send me an email.
Right.
And I'd like to thank him for his care and attention to me when he found out that I'd been injured. So thank you very much, Deep Throat.
He's been a big contributor, the Deep Throat, over over the last recent times.
He has been, yes.
Yes. So actually, well, while we're on the subject of Deep Throat, for our younger audience, you know, it was suggested to me by a listener that, what's this Deep Throat business? Sounds like a porno name. And an honest mistake. And I did explain that, in fact, in the famous Watergate scandal, where the reporters had an inside man with knowledge about things that were going on, and his code name was Deep Throat. So it's if it's a perfectly innocent and legitimate name to use for our Deep Throat.
Absolutely, yeah.
Actually, I think he likes it more than the 12th man likes his name. So his emails to me now are signed off covertly Deep Throat. So
Deep Throat, yes.
So yeah. I think Deep Throat's getting into the spirit of things. Thank you, Deep Throat.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, Scott, you know, we can't go past the plebiscite and the goings on in recent times.
No,
what have you got to say
can't.
About that?
We won't start with the most recent news yet. We'll go back to the stuff that from the Age, the Turnbull government war over funding of same-sex marriage plebiscite.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like the idea of a plebiscite, however. If it's the only way to go forward with it, then we should have it. However, I do not believe that 1 cent of taxpayers' money should go to fund either of those campaigns. The campaign for the marriage equality is well set up and well rehearsed and all the rest of it, and they'd be able to get money coming into them and that sort of stuff. They could fund their own campaign.
Mm-hmm.
The churches and the ACL, they've got tax-exempt status. They've got everything else building up to them for years and years and years. They've got plenty of money to fund their own campaign also. So I do not agree at all with the government is looking at funding them. Now, that happened after... Sorry, that was the Age, Turnbull government war over funding for same-sex marriage plebiscite. Then on the Brisbane Times, Cabinet weighs up February plebiscite and same-sex marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in that somewhere, I believe. No, it must be somewhere else I was listening to. I was reading it out. There it is. has also been Fairfax Media has also been told the Cabinet heard arguments for and against public funding for the yes and no campaigns, and that a figure of $7.5 million for each side was penciled in, though this figure has not yet been agreed to by the party room. Now, Warren Inch is a long-time supporter of same-sex marriage. He's on the coalition side, and he has come out right and said that it would be wrong to fund either side. it's crazy that they're going down this route. Then, the news from tonight, ABC... Shorten expected to tell Labor MPs and senators to block the plebiscite.
Mm.
So the plebiscite is going nowhere. It's another case of we've been led to a point and now it's going to be knocked on the head by crossbenchers and the Labor opposition.
Uh-huh.
So That is, to me, a little disappointing. I thought that we are better off proceeding and going ahead with it and that sort of stuff than we are staying away from it. However, the powers that be have decided against that, and they're going to block the plebiscite. So that's where we're at now.
I read somewhere where there was like 200 sort of gay right community groups, the leaders of which were in favour of not having a plebiscite.
Yeah, and that doesn't surprise me. There has been a number of gay rights movements and gay rights and same sex marriage proponents who have come out and said that they don't want a plebiscite.
I'm just amazed.
I don't understand that. I honestly don't understand that. I mean, it's ridiculous that we're going to spend this sort of money on it. But however, if it's the only way forward, then I think we are better off gritting our teeth and going through it and dealing with the abuse from the other side.
I've got a totally different mindset about this. You know, I would have, you know, 6 months ago in this situation, I think have been frustrated and whatever. But I think it's fantastic, Scott. The whole thing. It's just fantastic.
The whole thing is fantastic.
Because it's just exposing the forces of religion more and more to the general community. Like, eventually, the gay community is going to win this battle.
Yeah, the gay community is going to win it, and I said it on the first podcast when it was brought up all those months ago when Abbott faced down the party room and he ended up bringing in Rentatory. I said at the time it would be a bruising encounter, but I've no doubt that we would win. And I stand by that. I've no doubt we will win, but it will be a bruising encounter.
Yes,
I think we're better off having that bruising encounter. I really do.
Well, it's just going to take years now, and I think it's fantastic because, you know, so much of the general community is in favour of this, and it's just going to expose the religious forces for what they are, and you know, they'll cop some heavy flack in this battle, which will help us in the general war, Scott. So,
well, I agree wholeheartedly. Yeah, it really will. It's you know, I mean, I was having a discussion with my better half tonight, and I said to him, because he's actually in favour of them blocking the plebiscite and that sort of stuff, and I said, but you know, you've then got to wait 3 more years, and you've got to be convinced that the coalition government doesn't win office. And then you'll get a conscience vote. And I said, so what are you going to do? You're going to wait 3 years, lose the election, and then turn around and say, okay, now we'll have a plebiscite? You know, it's crazy. And, you know, you could also have, by then, Morrison could be the leader.
Oh, God.
And you see... Yeah, I heard you say that. Yeah, you know, Morrison could be the leader by then, and in which case, you know, they're not going to get a favourable run for the plebiscite. It really is very unlikely that it really is very ugly.
Yep, tactical mistake, I reckon, by the gay rights forces, but in the long run, that'll be to our advantage because they'll be on our side until this one's over. So. So that's interesting.
Yeah, it is.
From one of those articles, just the one from The Age, the Anglican Archbishop of Sydney, Glenn Davies, said Mr. Turnbull gave an unambiguous offer to provide taxpayer funding at a meeting in February, a claim backed by Australian Christian Lobby Director Lyle Shelton. So, you know...
Can you imagine Turnbull being unambiguous with handing over taxpayers' money to anyone?
Well, it's just the fingers of the religious groups in our politics. They're up to their armpits in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so that's the plebiscite. There'll be much more on that one in the coming weeks. Although, now, we did mention last week
in relation to Deep Throat attending that meeting at a church in Ashgrove and being quite intimidated by the goings on there. And yeah. I just received an email today from Wendy Francis of the ACL inviting me to the book launch of David Van Gen's new book. His book is titled Stealing from a Child, The Injustice of Marriage Equality. So,
you know, it really is crazy that they still try and push this barrow.
Well, Scott,
that you need to have a mother and a father.
Perhaps you and Deep Throat and other listeners
could attend the book launch.
Could attend the book launch, which is at Malian College, Gaythorne, 7 p.m. on Friday, the 23rd of September. Not far off, Scott.
23rd of September.
Friday the 23rd.
Yeah, I'm free,
7 p.m.
actually.
You're free.
Okay, Deep Throat. If you're interested, we'll go to the book launch.
Okay, and any others who are interested?
Any others that wanted to go to? Yeah, please contact us, and we'll go to the book launch.
Yeah, send us a message on Facebook or something, and we'll get a little group together. And I can't guarantee I'm going to that one, Scott, but. But maybe I'll have a look and see what I haven't even looked to see what I've got on, but. But there we go. We might try and get a little group attend to that. And then maybe with enough bodies, Deep Throat will reveal him or herself and ask some questions. Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Right. So just once again, the title of that book, Stealing from a Child, The Injustice of Marriage Equality.
It really is ridiculous, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Another friend of the program, Joe, sent me a link, and this was an interesting one, to a website called Christian Jobs Australia.
Yes.
So you can go to www.christianjobs.com.au and see how you go looking up for a job.
Exactly.
A Christian job, of course. So, Scott, I'm on there now. I've gone accounting as the category. Queensland, I figure you don't want to travel too far. Quick search, and unfortunately, no positions available for you at this time. I put in sales rep before, there was nothing for me either. Sort of scroll down the page to look at some of the offerings there. Music teachers, personal assistant, mission licensing coordinator, community engagement manager, business development manager. So, actually, there was one I saw. Actually, it was for a bus driver. And I remember thinking, God, they were full on about the Christianity required for that. But it's disappeared from the screen at this stage. So there you go. You know, would anyone have the temerity to have a website, you know, Atheist Jobs Australia, where specifically you're denied a job if you're Christian?
Well, you know, it would be interesting to see if someone did do that, but I don't think it'd work, you know,
well,
because, I mean, most atheists would just apply via Seek because, you know, Seek doesn't discriminate based on your religion.
Yeah, and, well, you wouldn't be protected from the anti-discrimination acts in the way that the religious groups are, so you couldn't do the reverse. So, So there you are. That's out there. If you've thought you've heard of it all, Christian Jobs Australia is available. Scott, we get an opportunity to talk about submarines this week. Saw this article.
I bet you were very happy when you saw this one, weren't you?
Yeah, dear listener, just a little insight into my life, but, you know, scouring news feeds and blogs and whatever, and when this one popped out about submarines, I was just jumping for joy. So this one, got a link to it from ABC News website. Dick Smith says, "We're being conned." A group of prominent businessmen, including Dick Smith and John Singleton, have taken out a full-page ad in the Australian newspaper suggesting the public is being conned over the submarine project.
The Australian government stipulated the winning contract would need to use conventional power, ruling out larger nuclear-powered submarines. Mr. Smith said the redesigned version of the submarine would have to be converted to a diesel engine, but he told ABC Adelaide it was a ludicrous plan and he believed it would never happen. Quoting Dick Smith here, "So the plan is for us to buy a nuclear submarine design and then convert it to a piston submarine. Now, no one has ever done that in the world, and in fact, when I talk to submarine experts, they say it is so ridiculous, so we're being conned." Mr. Smith said, if the government's real agenda was to use nuclear technology, it should be upfront about it. The world's coming round to my view. At least Dick Smith and John Singleton are coming round to it, Scott.
Well, yeah, I mean, they are coming round to it because it makes perfect sense that you don't buy something that's designed to run with a nuclear propulsion system and convert it to run on diesel piston engines. It's crazy.
It's a pretty fundamental design change.
It is a very fundamental design change. Mm. It's absolutely crazy that they would consider doing it.
Yes. Nick Xenophon said more detail about the submarines project was needed, but he questioned the motives behind Mr. Smith's campaign. South Australian Defence Industries Minister Martin Hamilton Smith said he trusted the decision. "I think the Navy chose that rather than the government, and you have to trust their judgment," Mr. Hamilton Smith said. "Because, gee, it's not like any, you know, armed forces have ever got us into trouble with bad mistakes in the past, have they?"
No, that's exactly it. You know, you can't ever question anything the armed forces have done, have you?
Yep. So that's good.
I did like the South Australian Premier Jay Weatherall hit out at Mr. Smith on Twitter, calling the businessman a sad old man.
Mm.
Looked like it, the advert, was scribbled on the back of a serviette after a long lunch. Sad old man.
Scott, I mean, up until now, objection to the submarines has only appeared in two obscure places. One is John Menadue's blog, and the other one is the Iron Fist Velvet Glove podcast. Like,
yes.
That is the only two places that there's been negative comment about these submarines in the last 12 months, and finally it started to hit mainstream media because someone like Dick Smith and Singleton actually put their money in their pockets and put a big bat ad in a newspaper. Like, that's the only way it could happen.
Yeah, and it's crazy to ignore them. It really would be crazy.
Hmm. Well, dear listener, if you've been listening to the last 61 episodes, you are ahead of the game on the submarine score and fully informed. So, on other things, Scott, an article here about refugees in Germany and almost 1,500 refugees are underage and married. So 1,475 refugees under 18, mostly girls, are already married. One in four of those is less than 14 years old. Most of them from Syria, 664, then Afghanistan, Iraq, Bulgaria, Poland, Romania, and Greece, where these married minor refugees are coming from. It's just another example, Scott, of how these refugees are from almost different planets. The cultural differences between where they are coming from and where they're going to are just enormous.
Well, yeah. Excuse me. You understand Afghanistan having a reasonable number, but 664 coming from Syria. I thought before the Syrian regime was attempted to be toppled, it was quite a civilized country. But apparently not, because you've got 664 coming from Syria. You know,
Maybe that's because there are just a lot more Syrian refugees than Afghanistani refugees, in this case of Germany. Maybe, I'm not sure.
Well, maybe, but it's... Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
I mean, I read it and I didn't really know what to say about it other than they're barbaric.
It's
really disgusting that you've got girls under the age of 14 being married. You know, it's ridiculous. You've got this situation that you've got, and marriage in Germany is 18, but exceptions can be made for 16-year-old children if they have their parents' permission. Mm. Well, you would imagine that the parents are going to give their permission for their children to get married. Mm. So, you know, I was really appalled by the whole thing.
Yeah. So, oh dear. Another part of this report, it says, a government report from 2012 revealed that more than half of all Muslim marriages in Germany involve a bride under 18. So, so that's just from refugees who have, or immigrants who have made it into Germany, who are Muslim, half of them involve a bride under 18. So, oh God, you're so young, you know nothing when you're 18 and or less, and getting married to somebody for
16,
life.
Getting married at 16 is way, way too young.
Mm.
18's too young. Yeah. But, you know, at least at 18 you've achieved majority and that sort of stuff, so you can say that you're an adult.
Yeah.
But 16, you can't, you know.
Never hear from people who sort of say we should just throw open the gates and let in as many refugees as, you know, want to come, just what their attitude would be to that category of refugees and what they think should happen. It'd be interesting to see what the left says should happen in a situation like that, what the left position is on a 14-year-old girl married to a 35, 40-year-old man coming in as a refugee. You know, what is the left's position on that? Haven't heard it stated.
I haven't heard it stated either. I would love to hear it stated. I'd love to find out what they would want to do with it.
Mm.
Because yeah. in a situation like that, you can't turn them away simply because, well, they're married, but you've got to impress your own views of the world on the new arrivals, and you've got to say, we're sorry, she's not 18, therefore any sexual contact between the two of you is illegal.
Yes.
You know? It really is.
And we simply do not recognise that marriage.
No, exactly. Yeah. I wholeheartedly agree that they're just going to have to say we don't recognise the marriage.
Mm.
You know, if the girl doesn't have members of her own family arriving there with them, then she's going to have to be made a ward of the state.
Mm. Yep. That would be the end result, I think, Scott. I don't know that it's happened here in Australia, but in terms of refugees, because obviously nobody gets in, but yeah, it's a tricky one for Europe. What a mess. What a mess.
It is a mess, yeah.
Mm. Scott, I have been fascinated by this brouhaha in relation to the Brisbane Writers' Festival and the keynote address that was given by an author.
I read the whole thing because the Guardian's got the whole transcript of the speech.
Yes.
And frankly, it sounds like a storm in a teacup, or have I missed something?
A bit of a storm in a teacup, but it's also just indicative of our society in many ways, Scott, so it's sort of worth exploring. So we'll spend a bit of time on it. So, dear listener, Brisbane Writers Festival, a keynote speech was given by an American author, a lady called Lionel Shriver, and she gave her speech, and in the middle of it, one of the writers attending, and a notable sort of person, a Yasmin Abdul Magyed, she walked out because she was so offended by what was said in the speech that she just could not bear to sit there and listen to it anymore, and walked out. So what I'm going to do, I think the order of doing this, is give Yasmin's reasons for walking out and then turn to Lionel Shriver's speech and what she actually said, and see what develops from that, Scott. So,
no problem at all.
So Yasmin says that until then she'd never walked out on a speech in her life until then. And she said, well, Lionel Shriver was, you know, to pose an interesting question. What are fiction writers allowed to write, given that they will never truly know another person's experience? Not every crime writer is... I'm quoting here from Yasmin's blog. Not every crime writer is a criminal, Lionel said, nor is every author who writes on sexual assault a rapist. Fiction, by its very nature, Shriver said, is fake. And Yasmin says that this is a fascinating philosophical argument. So the discussion was going to be by Lionel Shriver saying, are people entitled to write about things that they haven't experienced themselves? No prizes for guessing that Lionel Shriver's speech was, of course they are, we're fiction writers. But this Yasmin, she's not just some ordinary writer. Like, I'll have to look up her biography, but she's some sort of you know, Australian Youth of the Year or something like that. She's got quite a reasonable profile. But she described the speech as a poisoned package wrapped up in arrogance and delivered with condescension. As the chuckles of the audience swelled around me, reinforcing and legitimising the words coming from behind the lectern, I breathed in deeply, trying to make sense of what I was hearing. The stench of privilege hung heavily in the air, and I was reminded of my place in the world. Basically, let me just see where I get to the guts of what she's saying. She's got a thing about cultural appropriation. She says it is a thing because of our histories. The history of colonisation, where everything was taken from a people the world over. Land, wealth, dignity. And now identity is to be taken as well. So, Yasmin Abdul-Majid says it's just not legitimate for a white Caucasian female fiction writer to write a piece of fiction from the point of view of say, an African Nigerian woman or something like that. Because two reasons, the African Nigerian woman isn't in a position to write the piece herself, so she's deprived of the privilege of writing and telling her own story. And secondly, it's a kind of theft of identity of the Nigerian woman. So that's what Yasmin Abdul-Majid was saying. And now we'll turn to Lionel Shriver's actual speech, which, dear listener, it's in The Guardian. There's a link to it. Scott, I thought it was a really, really good speech.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's why I said I thought to myself, is it a storm in a teacup?
Really well written. So,
yeah.
Dear listener, we'll take the time to actually quote a fair bit of this. So, the title of it was, I hope the concept of cultural appropriation is a passing fad. First of all, she says, you have to hand it to the festival's organisers. Inviting a renowned iconoclast. Scott, do you know what iconoclast definition? I've got it here.
Actually, no, I don't know what an iconoclast is, so please tell me.
Please, a person who attacks or criticises cherished beliefs or institutions.
We're being iconoclastic about religion then, are we?
We are indeed, because the second sort of definition here is a destroyer of images used in religious worship in particular. There you go. We're iconoclasts, Scott. You have to hand it to the organisers, inviting a renowned iconoclast to speak about community and belonging is like expecting a great white shark to balance a beach ball on its nose. So she said, you know, when they asked her to do the speech, they should have known what they were going to get. And she says this ideology of cultural appropriation, taken to its logical conclusion, challenges our right to create fiction at all. She starts with an example of a tempest in a teacup at Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine, earlier this year. Two students, both members of student government, threw a tequila-themed birthday party for a friend. The hosts provided attendees with miniature sombreros, which numerous partygoers wore. When photos of the party circulated on social media, campus-wide outrage ensued. Partygoers were placed on social probation while the two hosts were ejected from their dorm and later impeached. The student government demanded that administrators create a safe space for those students who have been or feel specifically targeted. The tequila party, the statement specified, and the party hats constituted cultural appropriation. You can't go to uni, Scott, and throw a tequila party with a Mexican sombrero hat without getting into trouble. Just because you've appropriated the Mexican culture as well as...
I found that really, you know, then it goes on, where students of colour, particularly Latino and especially Mexican, feel unsafe. In sum, the party favour hats constituted, wait for it, cultural appropriation. You know, it's crazy that they would have a... You know, they didn't get expelled, did they? They just lost their position in the government, yeah?
Well, ejected from their dorm and later impeached, whatever that means. But, Scott, it's, you know, the do-gooders in this situation who are looking and going, oh, the poor Latinos will be so offended by this, you know, we have to protect them. It's actually racist and condescending by the leftist, by the regressive left, to suggest that all Latinos can't handle a bit of fun with their culture. Like, I mean, if it was an Aussie-themed party with, you know, cork hats and, you know, VB beer or something,
sausage rolls, yeah.
You know, are we to be offended or feel victimised? No. Like, give people some credit. Like, it's actually... If there's any insult in that whole saga, it is of the left insulting the Latinos for having such a fragile, supposedly fragile mindset. Really, you know, that's where the insult is, I think. Anyway.
Yeah.
What this Lionel Shriver says is, so what does a sombrero incident have to do with writing fiction? She says, the moral of the sombrero scandal is clear. You're not supposed to try on other people's hats. Yet, as fiction writers, that's what we're paid to do, isn't it? Step into other people's shoes and try on their hats. In the latest ethos, which has been spun well beyond college campuses in short order, any tradition, any experience, any costume, any way of doing or saying things that is associated with a minority or disadvantaged group is ring-fenced. Look but don't touch. Those who embrace a vast range of identities, ethnicities, nationalities, races, sexual and gender categories, classes of economic underprivilege and disability, are now encouraged to be possessive of their experience and to regard other people's attempts to participate in their lives and traditions, either actively or imaginatively, as a form of theft.
She's quite right. That is what this
Yasmin is viewing it is a form of theft. Oh my goodness. The author of Who Owns Culture, Appropriation and Authenticity in American Law, a Susan Scafidi, a law professor at Fordham University, defines cultural appropriation as taking intellectual property, traditional knowledge, cultural expressions or artefacts from someone else's culture without permission. And Lionel Shriver makes the point, well, without permission, who are you going to ask for permission? You know,
well, that's it. Yeah, you can't ask for permission.
Yes. Like, there's not some all-encompassing group that you can get signed off on if you want to throw a tequila-themed Mexican party.
Exactly. wanting to throw a tequila-themed party, who are you going to ask for permission?
You have to go to the Mexican embassy or something. So,
apparently so, yeah. Mm.
She says, I'm hopeful the concept of cultural appropriation is a passing fad. People with different backgrounds rubbing up against each other and exchanging ideas and practices is self-evidently one of the most productive, fascinating aspects of modern urban life. Exactly right. If people are experiencing or trying to experience other people's culture and to participate in it, you should be encouraging it so that there's mutual understanding. When people step into somebody else's shoes in whatever form, that's when they start to really communicate.
That's it, yeah, precisely.
The majority of these farcical cases of appropriation have concentrated on fashion, dance and music. So Scott, apparently Katy Perry got it in the neck for dressing like a geisha at the American Music Awards.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
An Arab-American writer, Randa Jarrah, says white Americans cannot practice belly dancing because it would be an appropriation of Eastern dance. Iggy Azalea committed cultural crimes by imitating African rap and speaking in blaccent. In the University of Ottawa in Canada, a yoga teacher was shamed into suspending her class because yoga originally comes from India. She offered to retitle the course Mindful Stretching. students at Oberlin College in Ohio have protested culturally appropriated food like sushi in their dining hall. We have reached the point where white people are asking whether it's appropriate to eat pad thai. For goodness sake. This Lionel Shriver makes the point, who's the premier pickpocket in the arts world, and it's fiction writers, that's who. So she's defending fiction writers' rights to appropriate stuff, to write fiction. You know, if you don't do that, then, you know, if she didn't appropriate stuff that she hadn't experienced, she'd just be, you know, left to be writing about a straight white female born in North Carolina, close on 60, as the only character in any book that she wrote.
Exactly. And, you know, and that leaves, you know, if you are only able to write about yourself, then we're going to become a very narrow-focused people, aren't we?
Hmm.
You know.
And she says, you know, if she just writes a book about, you know, white Anglo-Saxons in America, then she gets criticised for not having cultural diversity in her writing anyway. Like, you can't exactly. win. Other people will say, well, where's the black person in your story? Ah, dear, oh dear. Especially for writers from traditionally privileged demographics, the message seems to be that it's a whole lot safer just to make all your characters from the same demographic so you can be as hard on them as you care to be and do it with them what you like. If you start taking on minor groups, then you've got to be careful how you treat them. Apparently, 10 years ago, she gave the opening address at this same Brisbane festival, and she said at that time, fiction writers have a vested interest in protecting everyone's right to offend others, because if hurting someone else's feelings, even inadvertently, is sufficient justification for muzzling, there will always be someone out there who is miffed by what you say, and freedom of speech is dead. With the rise of identity politics, which privileges a subjective sense of injury as actionable basis for prosecution, that is a battle that in the decades since I last spoke in Brisbane, we've been losing. Goes on to say that this left's embrace of this gotcha hypersensitivity invariably invites backlash. Donald Trump appeals to people who have had it up to their eyeballs with being told what they can and cannot say. That's why he gets his supporters. She wrote a book about obesity. And she did it because she lost her own brother who died from complications of morbid obesity. And she got into arguments with people from the obesity sort of advocacy groups who said she had no right to get involved in advocating for obese people because she wasn't obese herself and she should just stay out of it. And this is a phenomenon that's becoming more common.
See, I find that ridiculous, because if you've got no one standing up for obese people unless they are obese themselves, you're never going to get anywhere.
Final point here. As writers and as people, we should be seeking to push beyond the constraining categories into which we have been arbitrarily dropped by birth. If we embrace narrow group-based identities too fiercely, we cling to the very cages in which others would seek to trap us. We pigeonhole ourselves. And I think that's the mistake that that this blogger, Yasmin Abdul-Majid, has made, in that she's just categorised herself into being, I think she's Nigerian or African, first, and like, you're Australian first now. You know, that's... she's basically putting herself into a cage, which she doesn't have to be in. She's pigeonholing herself constantly. So I thought that was all very interesting, Scott.
Yeah, it is very interesting for sure. And, you know, I read the speech, thoroughly enjoyed it and that sort of stuff, and I was thinking to myself, this is a storm in a teacup. And then, you know, it's only when you sit and analyse it and that sort of stuff you can, well, I can see where the other side's coming from, but I don't agree with them.
I really like the way she writes. It's made me inclined to buy a Lionel Shriver book and give it a go. I think she's probably producing some good stuff. Scott, Essential Report is out. Political donations. You've mentioned in the past, Scott. Well, here's the question. Should political parties be allowed to receive donations from each of the following? And they've got a list there. Property developers, foreign companies, Australian companies, mining companies, energy companies, blah, blah, blah. Should political parties be allowed to receive donations from each of the following? And from Australian companies, should be allowed 32%. Should not be allowed 51%. So significant numbers still think Australian companies should be able to. From individual Australian voters, they say yes. 50% of people think yes, they should be, and 35% say should not be allowed. So even property developers.
35% said individuals shouldn't be allowed to donate to a political party.
Correct. Yep.
Where the hell do they expect they're going to get their funding from?
Well, that would be from either no funding or from the public purse, I guess. That's a model that's suggested, isn't it?
I suppose, yeah, but still and all, it's,
that would make...
nice.
Yeah. Also, on the Essential Report, Racial Discrimination Act. Do you approve or disapprove of the proposal to change the Racial Discrimination Act so it is no longer unlawful to offend or insult someone because of their race or ethnicity? It will still be unlawful to humiliate or intimidate someone. So, do you approve of the proposal to change the Racial Discrimination Act? How many do you reckon were in favour and how many were not?
Yes. 40% were probably in favour and 50% were opposed and 10% undecided.
Right, not bad. 45% approve and 35% disapprove.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the commentary in the media, Scott, would be saying, what are you all worried about with this 18C? Like, it's really only been the religious right who have been the ones wanting it changed, and that's the only thing that we're in agreement with them, Scott, I think.
Yeah, it is the only thing we're in agreement with.
It's the only thing we're in agreement with. But most of the commentary outside of the religious right, from just the rest of the population, is very pro-18C. But the general public, 45% of them, say, no thanks, don't want it in that format. So that's interesting.
It is interesting, yeah. You know, it's one of those minor issues that I don't think we'll ever get... Oh, I don't think it'll change in this term of Parliament or even the next term of Parliament. It would have to change if the Tories had a majority in both houses of Parliament.
Right.
Which is unlikely in the next little while. But but we're still got to see the full shakeout of the Senate voting and that sort of stuff too. So, you know, it was a double dissolution this time. Next time round, it could be very different in the Senate.
The other one here, which was on illegal drugs, option A, we should decriminalise all illegal drugs. Option B, we should decriminalise small-scale illegal drugs. And option C, we should prohibit all activities relating to illegal drugs. And people were asked to pick one of those. Decriminalise all was 11%. Decriminalised the small-scale stuff, 31%, and prohibit all activities related to illegal drugs was 48%. Scott, we've got work to do on that one. That's
we do, yeah.
Yeah. That's one of the next cabs off the rank once the marriage plebiscite, or the marriage equality argument. We can only handle, you know, one discussion topic in Australia at a time, it seems. So,
yeah, you know, it seems to me that we've got to get marriage equality done first, then after that we've got to move on to voluntary euthanasia.
Yes.
And then after that we should then start tackling drugs, I think.
Yeah, probably about 20 years' time at the rate things are going.
Probably.
Would be by the time we get there.
Mm.
I've got an article here about, from The Conversation. Title is, "We have a moral obligation to allow drug analysis at music festivals." I agree. I reckon we should. I've seen this on, you know, Four Corners or something like that. What happens in some countries in Europe where they have a little van outside a dance club, and if you've got tablet...
You go and get it analysed,
You can go and get it analysed, and you know what you're taking, and people can be quite shocked at the impurities in the tablet they've got, and they don't take it then. Like, they won't. So we could do something similar in Australia. Like, it's...
Well, look, you know, I mean, it's...
It makes sense.
It makes perfect sense because, let's face it, the cops aren't going to pull you up for having a couple of ecstasy tablets on your person. So, you know, we should throw open the whole... We should throw open the lights and that sort of stuff and shine lights on the drugs as they are now and let people know exactly what's involved, what they're taking, and then they can sit there and actually have an informed decision before they actually swallow their ecstasy tablet. And they could find out that they could be swallowing cocaine, or they could be swallowing heroin, or they could be swallowing MDMA. You know, but at least they're going to know. And if they find out that there's full of impurities and they decide not to take the damn thing, well, that's all power to them, you know, because they've found out what's in there. And it's, if anything, you'd think the cops would be in favour of it, because they're probably going to find that if there's a bad batch of ecstasy drugs getting out there, that they're going to end up losing more than half of them down the bin. So I think it's a great idea.
Plus, can you imagine, like, all the ambulance calls that are required and people having their stomach pumped and the deaths of people?
Yeah.
I think there were 7 deaths last year from... seven people lost their lives after taking ecstasy in Australia last year, in 2015. 6 of these were at music festivals. So it's a really simple thing. Now, people might say, well, that's just an extraordinary leap for us to take to more or less condone drug taking and more or less assist people. But, Scott, there's a precedent for it.
Yeah.
And very early days of this podcast, we mentioned the injecting centres in King's Cross.
Yeah, that's true, yes.
And so in King's Cross, there are injecting rooms where you can go and there'll be people who will watch you and look after you when you inject yourself with an illegal drug and to make sure that you're okay. So it's not that big a leap from that sort of situation, is it?
No, it's not a big leap at all. It's actually a smaller leap than what you've got with the injecting rooms, because pills, you swallow them. Whereas injecting, you've got to, you got to get a clean syringe, all that sort of stuff. I think it's, I think the whole point, it's got great, it is a great point to it. It really does make sense.
Mm. The other thing is, so from this article, 400,000 young Australians take ecstasy every year.
Mm.
Many have no idea what is really in their pills. Annually, taxpayers spend $1 million per jurisdiction, I think this means per state, maintaining a force of drug dogs, largely used at these events. So, drug test, and you know, relatively ineffective at reducing drug use. Drug testing, on the other hand, could be implemented for less than a tenth of the cost of the drug dogs. And the campaigners for this sort of system are not requesting government funding. They're just asking for permission to provide drug testing stations that will prevent unnecessary harm to festival goers. It's a privately funded public health intervention that is being proposed. Ah, it's such a good idea, and it just won't happen, Scott.
Well, it's unfortunate because it makes perfect sense. It really does. Mm.
Everybody has been just brainwashed by the war on drugs, and including your partner. I've got here, Scott, a copy for him. Next time I see you, perhaps it'll be at that book launch at Ashgrove on a Friday. Chasing the Scream. Read that book, and you'll get a whole new perspective on drug legalisation. I'll lend it to you. So
thank you very much.
Actually, are you going on Sunday? Are we going to see?
Yeah,
you
I'm
there?
Going on Sunday. Yes,
I'll bring it then. Okay,
no worries.
Let me just see what else we've got here. Venezuelan. In Venezuela, times are tough. The country is
very
a mess.
Tough. Yeah.
The oil price has plummeted, and that was their main source of income. And unfortunately for the Venezuelan women of childbearing age, they're of course in a Catholic-dominated country. Traditional contraceptives like condoms and birth control pills are virtually impossible to get in Venezuela. So what's happening is that people are lining up to get sterilized to avoid having pregnancies and raising a child that they can't afford. That's what it's come down to. This article talks about massive waiting lists at clinics for people trying to get sterilized because they just can't get access to normal everyday contraceptives. God, just goddamn Catholic Church. God,
yeah,
they're an
I
evil
mean,
bunch.
You can't blame the Catholics for this one. It is the fault of their central government, the way that they've mismanaged things. But having
you can blame
said
them
that,
for not allowing women to have contraceptives in the country.
Yeah, you can blame them for not allowing them to have contraceptives, but you can't blame the Catholic Church for the lack of the pill and that sort of stuff in the country, because it says there that the fall in the oil price has resulted in a shortage of contraceptive pills and in condoms. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sort of defending the Catholics here, but
I don't think it's the cost that has made these unavailable. Where does it say that? Because I think it's that in that country, because of the Catholic influence, that standard contraceptives are not available, not because of
I don't know about that. I thought that it was saying that there was a problem here. Since global oil prices plunged in 2015, Venezuela hasn't had the funds to import basic goods such as food and medicine, creating acute shortages and stirring anger towards the administration of President Nicolas Maduro.
Mm.
I read that as saying that it was the plunge in oil price that has resulted in the shortage in the condoms and birth control pills. Mm. But, you know, I could be wrong.
Oh, well, we'll have to investigate further the Venezuelan contraceptive issue.
But, yes.
the mortality rate for women giving birth for every 100,000 births.
That was shocking.
95 women die for every 100,000 births. in 2015.
That's the worst. That's the worst in Latin America.
State-sponsored sterilisation, because they have to go to a clinic for this, has rankled much of the clergy in the deeply Catholic country, with the Archbishop of Merida, Baltasar Porras, calling the procedures a barbarity. The Catholic Church strongly condemns any form of birth control and abortion in Venezuela. And abortion in Venezuela is illegal unless a woman's life is at risk. So, all right, well, I've had a crack, perhaps unjustly. We'll see if it's because of the influence of the Catholic Church making contraceptives unavailable or whether it's an economic reason.
Well, I just read that and thought it was the economic reason, that's all.
Finally, Scott, a really depressing, bizarre, awful, awful story where, dear listener, there's a link to it and this clip where this woman is morbidly obese, Monica Riley, in the United States. She wants to become the fattest woman in the world. She's currently 317 kilograms. She's 27 years old, and she wants to reach 1,000 pounds and become immobile. I would feel like a queen because Sid, that's her partner, would be waiting on me hand and foot, and he's excited about it too, she said. It's a sexual fantasy for us, and we talk about it a lot. He already has to help me get off the sofa and get me out of bed. His feeder boyfriend, Sid Riley, spends his day cooking for his girlfriend, feeding her over 8,000 calories every day. Sid loves to cook for me and hand feed me, and I've achieved so much since we got together. He feeds me around the clock, and I never have to get up to do anything, she says. Despite her plans to become completely immobile, Monica still wants to have children. We do plan to have children. There's nothing to stop me raising a child from my bedroom, she said. We would get a nanny in to help around the house and take the baby out and about. Dear listener, this Sid is the most creepy, horrible bastard on the planet, where he's got this deluded woman who's he's feeding. He mixes up stuff into a funnel and just pours it down her throat. Literally, you have to see the video. And it's completely nuts. And the reason I just want to raise it is that we can look at that and say, that is completely nuts. But there are members of her family who say, when you watch the video, they say, well, I don't agree with her, but if that's what she wants to do, I can't stop her, you know, like I can't, you know, I wish she wouldn't, but if that's, it's a cultural,
it's not moral cultural.
Relativism, it's a moral relativism gone mad, where you can just, where these people are just saying, well, you know, kind of saying, well, the reason I'm talking about this article is that I make the comparison, like, what if she said it was her religion to be fat? Then people would go, oh, you know, well, actually, we better not criticise her. Like, maybe becoming immobile is actually empowering.
Yeah, but, I mean,
you know, in the same way that wearing a burqa is empowering. Like, because she's not religious, we can quite freely say, and anybody on the planet is going to say, well, most people are, I'm going to say anybody, they're going to say, that's just ridiculous. You're nuts. You're deluded. You shouldn't be doing that. You know, somebody should step in here and help this poor woman. But
She's 700 pounds now, 317.5 kilos. So she's 70% of the way where she wants to get to an imperial ton. You know, yes. I'm really appalled by the whole thing. It's, you know, there's nothing good that you can say about it. You just think to yourself, you know, the picture of it on the front, she's eating ice cream. You just think to yourself, love, put the tub down, get up, go for a walk. You know, and I'm utterly appalled by the whole thing. It's utterly disgusting.
Lead Sid out the door and then close the door before he can get back in, because he is the creepiest, The guy should be up on a murder charge when she dies.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, he keeps feeding her and that sort of stuff. And, yeah it's really, really sick.
Yeah. So I guess my point is there would be some people out there, like we would criticise people because they're of religious reasons anyway, but some people out there would go, well, you know, that's just not okay. But if it was a religious reason, well, you know, slap on a burqa and stay indoors all the time, that is okay. Like, Scott, it's just an awful story that was kind of just like watching a train wreck type thing. If you really want to be creeped out by a terrible situation, have a look at that one. It was mind-boggling for me.
Yeah, it is mind-boggling. It's really disturbing. It's disgusting. It's beyond the whole, you know, you get in trouble for calling people fat and that sort of stuff. This goes well and truly beyond that. She is killing herself. Mm. And she doesn't seem to care.
Yeah. I mean, when people are insane, we pick them up and we take them to an asylum of some sort and give them treatment. And she's clearly deluded and needs that sort of help. And, you know, there comes a point with some religious people. Where's the boundary of that? Where do you say you are so deluded you're actually harming yourself? It's just an interesting point. Where is that point? I'm not saying people in burqa should end up in mental asylums, but at what point do we say, well, you really are harming yourself? And if you were slashing your wrists with a razor blade, we would take the razor blade off you and cart you off to hospital.
Exactly.
She's being fed by her creepy boyfriend, killing herself just more slowly, and we're okay with that. And then other people are harming themselves in other ways. It's just an interesting dilemma of at what point does society step in and say, you are deluded, you're actually acting against your own best interests here, we're stepping in.
Well, see, it's in the United States where you can't step in, so they just, you know, they're just going to let her go, but she's going to end up dead. You know, I found it incredible saying she's going to have children. She's no way she'd be able to carry a child.
No.
You know, she'd end up with gestational diabetes and all the rest of it.
Yep.
You know, it puts enormous strain on the heart going through childbirth anyway, and she's carrying well over the weight she should be. It's she's a heart attack waiting to happen.
All right, Scott. Well, we've about reached the end.
Yes, we have.
Yep. So I will see you Sunday. And,
no worries.
We've got an unusual secular party meeting at a different location. I think, Deep Throat won't be there. The 12th Man will be there, I think. We'll see what other characters from the podcast. There'll be a few of them there. We'll see if we can rustle up a group to go to the book launch. In the meantime, quick disclaimer, views expressed herein, not necessarily views of the Secular Party. Check out the website for full details. If you'd like to help, we'd like to hear from you. Last time I looked, Scott, we're still on 98 likes. I've kind of given in. It's a bit like the plebiscite. I've sort of given in that it'll ever happen. That, you know, marriage equality. We'll get to 100 likes when marriage equality becomes a reality. That's how I'm looking at it.
Well, I hope we get there before that happens. But anyway,
All right. I'll see you Sunday. We'll talk to you all next week.
Yeah. Thanks very much for listening, everyone. Bye now.
Bye. Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf, on their phone, and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon. and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation, so you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners, and that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.